The Perfectionist by Professor G.V. Subbaraman. At this time, I was blessed with the rare good fortune of working with Sri Bhagavan in the kitchen. The hours of duty were between 2:30 and 4 a.m. every night. Sri Bhagavan would come punctually at 2:30 and first spend some time cutting up vegetables with workers and devotees. Then he would enter the kitchen and prepare the sambar or chutney for next day's lunch, and occasionally for other dishes also. The sub-register, R. Narayana Iyer, you know, they had several Narayana Iyers. There was a Harbor Narayana Iyer. They called them that. They called them by their profession, so don't get it mixed up.
I know.
And he's the one that recognized the genius in Ramanuja, the mathematician, and gave him a job. Because he had no job or anything. That Harbor Narayana Iyer. He used to go to Bhagavan. He also was a mathematician. And someone did his PhD thesis on him in the USA. This Harbor Narayana Iyer. The sub-register, Narayana Iyer, the bookstall manager, Kalyana Sundaram Iyer, and myself used to assist Sri Bhagavan. Bhagavan was an Iyer also. Kataraman Iyer. You know, they're all, you know, Brahman. Smartha Brahman.
Smartha.
That means Shaivite. Somewhat, right? There's more to it than that.
They are not so strict. They are into both.
They're both, okay. Yeah. So the Iyer's kitchen.
There are quite a few Iyer's mess.
At first, I was an ignoramus in the work. As I saw Sri Bhagavan perspiring profusely near the oven, I tried to fan him, but he objected. He would not allow any distinction being shown to him. I stopped, but when he was engrossed in the work, I gently repeated the fanning. Turning to me, he laughed and said, "Oh, you want to do it on the sly, but you don't even know how to do it effectively. Let me teach you." So saying, he held my hand and taught me the proper way of waving the fan. Oh, how I thrilled at his touch and thanked my ignorance. From the kitchen, we would adjourn to another room for grinding the mixture. There too, I did not know at first how to hold the pestle and to grind. Sri Bhagavan placed his hand upon mine and turned the pestle in the proper way. Again, what a thrill. How blessed was my ignorance. After the work was finished, Sri Bhagavan would take a bit out from the dish, taste a little of it, and give us the remainder to taste. And sometimes when our hands were unwashed, he would himself throw it into our mouths with his own hand. That would be the climax of our happiness. Then he would hasten back to the hall and lie reclining on the couch and appear to be dozing as the Brahmins arrived to chant the Vedas in the morning. Squatting so close to Sri Bhagavan, chatting and joking with him, partaking of the fruit of his gracious labors, what a privilege and a fortune. That was indeed the most blessed period in the lives of us three. Its very recollection must thrill us throughout our lives. But this work with Bhagavan had its rigors as well as its pleasures. Though he was all mercy and grace, he was at the same time a strict disciplinarian. He would not tolerate the least sloppiness. Everything had to be done to perfection. Nothing was to be wasted or spoiled. He would demand full attention and implicit obedience to his directions. One night, a devotee who was an advocate insisted on sharing in the work. He was asked to shift the vessel containing sambar. And while he was doing so, a few drops were spilled. At once, Sri Bhagavan flared up and said, You are only fit for arguing in court. Such work is not for you. The poor man never again volunteered. Each one of us was allotted a duty and had to take his cue from a mere glance by Bhagavan. My duty, for instance, was to supply salt and water. And whenever Bhagavan looked at me, I had to bring one or the other, understanding which was needed. Usually we used to wake at 2 o'clock, finish our ablutions, and be ready before time to report for duty at 2:30. One night, however, I was 5 minutes late, and the work was already going on. Tasting the preparation, Sri Bhagavan said that there was a little too much salt, and turning to me, he added, "Since you were absent, I thought of you at the moment of adding salt, and that is the reason for the excess." That was his way of reprimanding me for my unpunctuality. On another occasion, the sour ingredient was slightly excessive. Sri Bhagavan tasted it and said jokingly, "Acidity is an effective remedy for giddiness, and since most of those who come here are more or less giddy, this preparation will do us a lot of good. But such slight errors were very rare. As all devotees and visitors would readily testify, the preparations were ordinarily of excellent taste. While the work was going on, Sri Bhagavan had a way of teaching the highest wisdom through homely, casual remarks. For instance, once, when the sambar was being boiled, he observed, "It must be thoroughly boiled, and all the effervescence must completely subside. Only then will it mature and acquire the right taste."
Even though the ashram sambar is the best.
Ashram food is the best.
Food is the best.
Suffer Little Children by N.N. Rajan. He was a station master, trained in Tiruvannamalai for some time, but other places also. His son was a bachelor, and he was a mountain path editor for maybe 15 years or so, Ramamani. Being a householder, I felt that it was not right for me to follow a spiritual path alone, so I began taking my wife and children also to Bhagavan's ashram. Within a few months, I found, to my astonishment, quite a conspicuous change in my wife, and noticed that she had outstripped me in her understanding of Bhagavan. She had become a greater devotee and was imbibing more peace from him. My children also enjoyed his presence, and he used to laugh and joke with them. Indeed, he had a special fondness for children, and often used to joke with them and touch or caress them. He scrupulously avoided touching adults or being touched by them. The children themselves derived a certain peace and joy from his presence, and would sometimes sit motionless before him, as though under a spell, free from childish wriggling. I am not exaggerating when I say this. Once my daughter, who was only just over 2, sat quietly by herself in a corner of the hall for about 2 hours, sitting cross-legged like adults and not even speaking. My wife and I did not notice this, since we were absorbed in meditation, but the Maharshi did. When I went there early next morning, I was surprised and delighted to hear the Maharshi telling one of the devotees about it. Rajan's little daughter, Kuti, was sitting cross-legged away from her parents for about 2 hours, and she never stirred the whole time. He laughed in a pleased and surprised way, and, as was his way, when anything happened that particularly delighted him, he repeated the story over and over again as fresh devotees came in. Actually, we say that things surprised him. But that is not strictly correct, because in his dynamic presence, even more remarkable things could happen. It was delightful to hear him talking about it and to realize how closely he had watched her while we knew nothing about it. Of course, it was due to his grace, as a child would not naturally act like that. She used to call him Grandpa, and sometimes in answering her, he would touch her head or pat her on the back. The touch of so exalted a sage, especially on the head, must have been hashta diksha and could not be without effect. He was omnipotent, but was so unostentatious that he would never reveal his powers openly, but behaved quite simply like an ordinary man. He used to joke with my two sons also, and would sometimes touch them. My second son was once offering some fruit, and the Maharshi laughed and took hold of his hand. My elder son, who was then 6 years old, used to recite Sanskrit verses and as prayers, both in the ashram and at home. If he said them too fast, Bhagavan would tell him to go slowly. And when he recited them at home, he would sometimes have a vision of Bhagavan and say to me, "Father, Bhagavan is telling me to go slowly." It was a wonderful experience to see my child gifted with such visions, but I myself had no such experiences. The children are grown up now, but all three still enjoy lasting benefits from the touch and blessings of Bhagavan.
Is the ashram still publishing his book, Bloom and Glory, or something?
I think they stopped.
They stopped.
Yeah.
What was the name of the group?
Bloom and something.
Of Inner Glory.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll see in the Guru Ramana video this interview with him. He's all emotional. Yeah. Ramana Jayanti by K. Lakshmana Sharma. Who?
Scholars.
I missed that. His obituary was in the July 65 issue. Quote, "The one letter, Om, shines inside the heart eternally of itself. How is it to be written?" Bhagavan Sri Ramana. Ramana has no jayanti of his own, because he is the unborn, timeless real self in us. So what we call his jayanti is only our jayanti, our birth in him, our real self. This birth is guaranteed to us. His sincere devotees, because he has looked on us with grace. Ramana is the formless, timeless, and spaceless Arunachala who dances at the eye in the heart. He has graciously taken a form that we may be relieved of the bondage of form. He is not a geographical entity, but the moveless Brahman of the Upanishads. Grace is his essence, and out of grace he has become our guru. Grace is not simply in Tiruvannamalai, but resides in our hearts. The heart is the true Arunachala. The might of his grace is infinite. It is invincible. By his look, we were caught in the net of his grace, and it will accomplish its work. There is no escape from it. His grace is like an unerring light of the sun. As it devours darkness, so grace devours ignorance and unreality. We need do nothing at all except to give our free consent that this work of grace shall be accomplished. To give our consent, we must realize the truth about the work of grace that it demands. In return for the gift of Ramana himself, our own too much cherished but wholly valueless false self, the ego, which makes us think and say, I am so and so. We must ourselves ardently desire to win him by paying this seeming price and surrender this ego to him. This highly profitable bargain is to be won by faith and loyalty. We need to have faith in the teaching of Ramana. We have such faith since we know that Ramana is the same as Bhagavat Pada, Sri Shankaracharya, and Sri Dakshinamurti, and that his words are the primary Upanishads, from which the ancient Upanishads themselves derive their authority. We do not go backward in time for our authority. We find the needful authority in Ramana alone. Though he tells us about the quest of the self by the question, who am I? He also tells us that even now, without our making the quest, we are that. And that itself is we. In other words, we are free by nature and always. That we are nitya mukta, bondage is unreal. Hence, our jayanti is not in the future, but now. All difference, including bondage, karma, etc., is unreal. He laughs at us for asking how we can become one with him, saying it is like a man in Tiruvannamalai asking the way to that place. Let him laugh at us, for that laugh is full of grace and will make us realize that we are he and do not need to become he. There is no room for discouragement, for remorse for our sins, or for fear of failure, for grace alone exists, and it is he. If we do wrong, let us not weep for it, but forget it at once, and joyfully take refuge in his grace. Must we do something like the squirrel at the Setu Bandhan?
Okay. Setu, bridging, making the bridge.
Oh, from Ram.
Setu.
Well, let us think of some of these truths of Ramana's grace and surrender our little selves to it. Once or twice a day, when we fall asleep and when we wake up, at other times, if remembrance comes of its own accord, let us rejoice in it. If we fail often to stick to our program, let us not waste thought in sinful regret, but go on with faith in his grace.
Because the squirrels help build the bridge.
Yeah.
And then Rava blessed the squirrel, that's why there are three stripes of them. Yeah. That's the legend.
The Pariyaparanam by Dr. Deva Sanapati.
What para?
Parya.
Pariyaparanam.
Parana. Although realization came to Sri Ramana Maharshi through a single act of self-inquiry, it was, let's say, as related by Professor Nagaraja Rao in another article in this issue, it was preceded by a phase when premonitions of divine grace haunted him. Two influences awakened these premonitions in him. The first was the mention of Arunachala, the holy hill. The second was the Pariyaparanam, or Great Puranam, a record of the famous Dhammo-Shaivite saints. As he read this, he was filled with awe and wonder and a spirit of emulation. Dr. Deva Sanapati, reader in philosophy at Madras University, Give us an account of this great compilation. Parya Puranam, known also as the Tirutandara Puranam, gives an account of the lives of the devotees of Shiva and the devotees of his devotees. Indeed, to be a devotee of a devotee is considered an even greater privilege than to be his own devotee. Written by Shekharar, the Pareya Puranam is based on a number of verses in praise of devotees by Saint Sundarar and a slightly more detailed account of them by Nambiandar Nambi. It was compiled about 800 years ago and since that time has come to occupy a place of honor in Tamil literature and in the hearts of Shaivites. You know, the Shiva Bhaktavilasam is a Sanskrit version, so there's some dispute whether what came first. No, in the ashram, whatever that is. I mean, Raman Ashram in India. In fact, this succession of the saints differing in age, sex, learning, profession, social status, etc. is characterized by the one common feature of steadfast love for the Lord of his devotee or his devotees. This love finds expression in various ways, in simple but unfailing adherence to one's religious duties, in deeds of outstanding courage, or in normally impossible feats. They're all a little bit extreme in their behaviors. They said to reach the extreme, to gain the supreme, there must be extreme. To gain the supreme, you must be extreme. You must...
Yes, intense at least.
Extreme. Well, there's some truth to this extreme thing.
But extreme and intense is good. Extremely rude.
In contrast to such spectacular heroism, we have accounts of quiet but nonetheless profound love. For instance, Posalar Nayanar wanted to build a temple but lacked the material means. Undaunted, he set to work to build it in his own mind, collecting the materials, starting the work on an auspicious day, proceeding methodically until the entire structure was completed, and all in his mind. He fixed the day for mentally opening it and installing the image of the deity. Then he found, to his surprise, that the Lord came rather to the opening of this mental temple of his than to one actually built by a king and to be opened on the same day. Or there is a story of Vayalar of Mylapore, whose worship, also inward, had even less form, installing the deity in the temple of the mind and by unceasing awareness of him, lighting the lamp of knowledge regarding relationship to him, bathing the deity in immortal bliss, offering love for the righteous to him as food, he worshipped the Lord. By this worship, which blossomed within him, he devoted himself daily to the Lord with unfailing love. It is usual to refer to the Tamil saints as 63. But their number is not restricted to this figure. A phrase in Sundarar's verse refers to those beyond, and this is usually taken to mean others outside Tamil Nadu, or from an earlier or later period, than covered in the Pareya Purana. Shekharar is aware of the difficulty of trying to describe the well-nigh inexpressible greatness of the saints. Paradoxically, this is the greatness of the lowly. The Tamil word, adiyar, means those at the feet of the Lord. So, adiyar in Madras.
No. In Chennai. Adiyar. This is adiyar. Adhyar.
That's different than Adhyar.
Adhyar.
Adhyar is wonderful.
You know, the attendants of Bhagavan, they also are sincere. Bhagavan or Adhyars?
Adhyar.
Sadhakas.
But so the Tamil word for Adhyar means at the feet of the Lord.
The seashore.
But they say at the feet of the Lord, Adhyar. They have faced themselves so completely at his feet that the Lord makes the world recognize them as chiefs or Nayanmars. Their greatness lies in realizing that their life centers in God, not in themselves. Shekalar says, I shall sing the praises of countless devotees whose greatness is immeasurable. While even to indicate the limit of their praise is difficult, impelled by boundless desire, I shall state their greatness. Unquote. The Tamil word, alarila, literally meaning measureless or limitless, is variously rendered here as countless and
measureless. That is measureless.
And boundless to suit the context. It is perhaps deliberately repeated by the author to indicate the infinitude of the theme. What inspires devotion is the infinite. The love or devotion that is inspired is also infinite. In fact, they seek to match the infinitude of the Lord by the infinitude of their love or devotion. Finitude of individual being is overcome by infinitude of love. Here is a passage describing the qualities common to them all, notwithstanding the rich variety of their personality. Like the white sacred ash which adorned their bodies, they were pure within also. By their effulgence, they illumined all places, and they were great beyond the praise of words. Even were the elements to deviate from their nature, these would never forget the feet of the Lord. They pursued the path of steadfast love. They were great as a mountain in the loftiness of their blameless character. Their wealth was beyond the vicissitudes of prosperity and adversity, a piece of gold and a pot's herd being alike to them. They worshipped because of the love that surged in them. So firm was their love that they cared not even for liberation. Their ornament was a rosary, their costume rags. What weighed with them was the Lord's will. Nothing else mattered. Actuated by love that was an eternal spring in them, they lacked nothing. In their heroism, such as I can express, all that I can do is to laud their exalted state. Their ancient glory continues without failing. How can I set it forth with due understanding? There's a short poem by A. Rao. Complete your work. Bhagavan, was it not you who gave these rhymes to me? My mind, the lens they filtered through, beautiful to see. And shall they now stay hid to lighten no man's way, a lamp beneath an iron lid, a prayer with none to pray? Complete your work, Bhagavan. Let them shine forth clear, a light held high for every man, to guide men to you here. early days with Bhagavan by Ramaswami Pillai. From boyhood, I was spiritually inclined. Although coming of a meat-eating family, I turned vegetarian while still a boy. I was mainly a worshipper of Shiva, but learned about Christ and Buddha too, and revered them. Twice I visited the great Muslim shrine at Nagore, and I understood that Allah was only another name for God. Where's Nagore? Nagore.
N-I-G-O-R?
N-A-G-O-R-E.
Oh. Sounds like Andhra Pradesh. Or misspelled Nagar.
It's New Delhi.
Misspelled Nagar.
My one ambition in life was to see God face to face. This was granted to me while still a schoolboy in March 1917, when I first went to Skanda Ashram and set eyes on Bhagavan. You know, his father was had a business, I think, he was a liquor distributor.
Oh,
and he was well-to-do and sent him to college even. Ramaswami Pillai and all that. When I first met him, Skanda Ashram, in 1917, reclining on the couch, he looked indescribably majestic. Since then, he has been God in human form for me, my God, Guru, and all. I did not ask for anything. I was filled to overflowing by just seeing him. He turned on me that look of heart-melting grace that he so often bestowed on newcomers. After a few days, I had to return home. There I learned the marital garland of letters and spent my time reciting it either mentally or aloud, and even writing it out. And I used to sing it there in the middle of the night in the guest house compound. And he had a very booming voice, you know, like at midnight or 2 a.m. He'll be singing it out.
Yeah.
And then the Westerners, you can see them lining up in the office complaining in the morning. You know. Or where they should be elated, you know, that he's reminding him 24 hours what the purpose is. And he used to sing in a different, not harmonize with anyone. So even during Bhagavan's time,
oh.
Very loud and in a different... Yeah, he'd be on a different note than everybody else. And even during Bhagavan's time, I remember he used to do it. He would do it in the Samadhi Hall sometimes also.
Okay.
But even in Bhagavan, they said, someone complained, you know, he's singing a lot of different notes and everybody's saying this. You think, oh, fine, leave him alone.
But in India, anyway, there's always noise, right? There's always prayers from the temple and mosque.
But they would sing, and they would do marital garland together. But he would sing.
Lots of Indians sing off key.
No Americans. Even when they are singing bhajans together, you know, one will go.
Yeah.
After finishing school, I went to college. Then I returned to my village. And although I had no desire for married life, my parents got me married. I had no children, however, and was soon able to give up married life and go and live with Bhagavan at his ashram. Bhagavan had lived in various caves and temples, but Skanda Ashram was the first to be known as an ashram. He stayed there for 7 years with his mother. His younger brother, Narendranananda Swami, who was to be the future Sarvadhikari, and a few sadhus. It was here that ashram cooking was first started. This was due to the presence of his mother. It was her presence that made it into an ashram. After her death, Bhagavan abandoned it and went to live beside her shrine at the foot of the hill, where the present ashram has grown up. This shows her to have had greater importance than commonly supposed. During his years at Skanda Ashram, Bhagavan still spoke little and seldom. It did not matter. His gaze was dynamic, penetrating, gracious, soul-stirring, ego-killing. In later years, he spoke far more. But his silences were still tremendous. It was on my second visit to Skanda Ashram that I first made Pradakshina. A visitor from Madurai, whom I knew, wanted to go around the hill with Bhagavan, and I joined them. At that time, the lower slopes were still forested, and we took the forest path for a good part of the way before coming out on the road. Next day, I had a sudden urge to go around by myself. I started out as before, but soon lost my way on the forest track. As I started, I had noticed that one of the ashram dogs was following me. Now it ran in front and began to lead. At once it flashed on me that it was Bhagavan's work. With tears of gratitude and joy, I followed my guide. He took me to the same place as the previous day until we came to the road and then disappeared. And I saw him at the ashram when I got back. At the time, I told nobody about this. It was my first experience of my spiritual relationship with Bhagavan, and I was more than ever convinced that he would guide me through the unknown paths of life. Such an incident may appear trivial to the reader, but when it actually happens, it strengthens one's faith in Bhagavan, who alone can help one by his infinite grace in opening one's inner vision. For a whole year at Skanda Ashram, Bhagavan took only one meager meal a day. I was on a visit there the day he broke his fast. I had decided to stay the night even though there was no food for an evening meal, even for the rest of us. I didn't feel hungry. At about 7:30, one of the devotees, Ramanatha Brahmachari, came back with some pieces of broken coconut and some rice that he had been given at a ceremony he had attended in town. Bhagavan suggested that we should boil it up on the charcoal stove we had there and to share it out, as was the usual custom. He told us to see whether there was any sugar or sugar candy left from gifts by earlier visitors to flavor it with. We looked, but there was nothing at all. It was dark and raining outside, and we could not well go into town for anything. I was near to tears that Bhagavan should ask for something, so rare an event, and we should not be able to provide it. At that very moment, the door opened, and two students came in with a bag of sugar candy and a bunch of bananas that they had brought to present to Bhagavan. The meal was cooked and eaten, the two visitors also being invited. Bhagavan remarked that we had asked for sugar candy and got bananas also, which could be cut up and served like a pickle with the food. After eating, he said that it was just a year, 365 days exactly, since he had limited himself to one meal a day, and that from now on he would eat in the evening also. That was how things happened with Bhagavan. He did not work miracles, and generally thought of as deliberate acts willed by a person. But happenings like this are the result of spiritual forces already and always at work. The Jnani is God himself in human form. He never wills anything, but things happen in his presence, and the ignorant attribute them to him. His state is pure awareness. It is a matter of experience. One may get a glimpse of it in his presence. It was in 1922 when the present ashram at the foot of the hill first started that I became a permanent resident. At first, there was only a thatched hut over the mother shrine, and a second small hut there served as a kitchen. There were only a few of us then. There were no ashram servants in those days. We did all the work ourselves, and Bhagavan along with us. Puja was performed twice a day, as it still is. We spent our time doing ashram work, chanting sacred songs, walking round the hill, meditating and reading spiritual books. Earlier, Bhagavan had been more silent and aloof. Later, when crowds began to come, he was necessarily more distant. But at this time, he took part in everything, guiding and helping in every activity of the growing ashram. He was our Lord and Guru, and was always with us. Devotees used to bring us provisions when they were needed, and we never felt any want. We used to share things out as they came. Sometimes there was even more than we could dispose of on the spot. We even used to make tea and coffee when the ingredients were available. Though this was an idyllic state in itself, the essence of it was our striving for realization. Having attained a human birth, that is the only goal worth aiming at, for it is unalloyed eternal bliss and peace. We can dwell on the name or form of Ramana or neither. Repeating the name Ramana inwardly is itself a good sadhana for those who do not use self-inquiry. Or by concentrating on him intensely and constantly, we may find in him the fire of knowledge which will burn up our ego and convert us into him, so that we realize our identity with him, who is the self of the self. The state of bliss thus attained through merging into the Guru is called Guru Turiya. It is a matter for experience and cannot be explained in words. The ego is only an accretion, a shadow, a ghost, an unstable outcome of the combination of chit and jada, consciousness and matter. It is the source of all mischief in our state of ignorance. Nothing is lost by its destruction. It obscures and conceals the true self of us, which is identical with pure consciousness. This false ego is to be dissolved by steady inquiry into it, or by the grace of our most gracious Sadguru Bhagavan Sri Ramana. Okay. Swami Nathan. I mean, Ramaswami Pillai. Yeah. He died at 100. Yeah.
100.
Yeah. He was still... And when he was in the 90s, he stopped walking pretty much, and Money used to ask me, take him, you know, I used to go visit him, he said, take him out to walk. So we just go out near his cottage there, you know, right on the corner there, right, you know, by those banyan trees along the back there.
Yeah, yeah.
He got, and he would look up in the mountain, and here, and he said, 100 years. Who would believe Bhagavan keep me 100 years? And he was hard of hearing. I said, Swami, you're only 97. Yeah. I had to shout it. He listened to me. 100 years. Who would think 100 years? I say it again, you're only 97. Yeah. And he did live 100 years,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Then he
lived
in the ashram?
In the ashram,
yes.
Yeah. He always lived there, you know.
And you would sit there staring at Arunachala.
Well, used, that was in the Morbi, he used to be in the Morbi, then they moved him into the main
compound.
I was next door to him one time. I remember waiting next to him.
He would exert on a Malay in the middle of the night.
Oh, nice. What a lovely experience.
Yeah.
So he's the one who built the steps, isn't it?
Yeah, he was the Bhagavan used to walk up to the mountain, and then the path, he thought it was too uneven everything. If you look at the photographs of it then, it's all sand.
Oh.
There's the rocks underneath, but there's all sand on top.
Sand, okay.
So perfectly smooth and everything. Probably not always as Kanarsan, but as far as Bhagavan used to walk. He went up walking up the hill.
You know, even if people singing often, you know, if you really know the meaning, especially the Tamil, this thing, you get really passionate and emotional, so they get carried away. That's I'm 30 years. Nice.
He's not the one who used to sing off-key.
Yes.
He's the one. So you heard him?
Yeah.
Well, he was singing loud.
Yeah, loud.
You see him also in the interview.
Yeah, very, very emotional.
The interview, he's quite loud, no? I mean, he's...
Yeah. There he was, what, 95? Or, no, he's 90 or something, right? He says how old he was. That interview, 90.
Tall man.
Beard, dark.
Yes.
You see him in the...
Yeah. I don't know. Very, very emotional.
Yeah. He spoke very well.
No, if you understand the meaning, especially the tunnel hymns, you just get carried away, you know. And sometimes people cry also.
Oh, that's
how
I sing all the time.
Yeah. You know what I want?
Who am I?
Like you lost something and you're looking for it. You know, he says in the video.
Oh, yeah. Who am I?
It's beautiful.